There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Folks, I've got to make a quick announcement, and I need you to listen to me on this, please. Tim is off. He has contracted COVID. He is doing his best to combat this. Part of the reason he wanted to keep this somewhat quiet was so that he would not have to field 1,000 questions on Facebook and social media and texts and messages. So let's respect his privacy, respect his health, and allow him to just do what it takes to heal, to get back to feeling well. So if you want to throw out a prayer and healing request for Tim, feel free to do so. But again, just make sure that people aren't bombarding him with messages. And if you do, don't expect an answer. Because really, he needs to focus on what he can do to get back to feeling well. And that's all we're going to focus on right now. So thank you very much for tuning into the show, spending some time with me here. It is a supernatural news parashare kind of day. And I'm not alone. Joining me on today's program, Winifred Schrader. Hello, Winnie.
Hello, hello.
All right. You're going to sit in. You're filling in for Tim. We've got a lot of cool news to get to. We've got some audio. We're going to be playing along. For those of you that are watching this on the YouTubes, thank you for tuning in and checking it out. We're just putting up some of these episodes as well to remind you that we're here. I will have pictures on the video episode that are popping up that deal with the different topics on today's programs. So make sure that you stay in with that. And today is our Headless Horseman edition of Supernatural News and Parashare. But before we get into that, I have a couple of quick things I want to make a mention of. First and foremost, I want to thank everybody for all the great birthday wishes. My birthday on Monday, where I turned 54, I got way too many messages. I cannot possibly answer them all, but thank you all from the bottom of my heart for the social media messages, the email messages, everything. It means a lot to me, and I appreciate you welcoming me into my 54th year, and that means a lot. What would really mean more to me is if this Friday you tune in to the new Shock Doc on Discovery Plus, Demon in the White House, begins streaming November 26th exclusively on Discovery Plus. And I know what you're thinking. It has nothing to do with the past or present. It actually talks about the spirituality of some of the former first ladies and their evoking spirits. And could that have opened up a portal inside the White House? There are many ghost stories surrounding the White House and many accounts from famous dignitaries and heads of state to former residents and employees of the White House. All that will be covered in the new documentary, Demon in the White House, streaming November 26th exclusively on Discovery Plus. I'm on that. Jeff Belanger's on there. Joshua P. Warren is on that. There are many other talking heads as we discuss the history and mysteries regarding the White House. So I'll check. We'll be talking about that. So please check that out this week as well. We went out, saw a movie this weekend. This was the first movie you and I have seen in a theater together since before the pandemic. Am I right?
Yeah, I have not been in a movie theater in almost 2 years until the other day when we went and saw this movie.
Ghostbusters Afterlife officially opened on November 19th. We went and saw it on Saturday the 20th. And I want to know, did you go in with any expectations for this movie?
Well, the expectations I had, you know, I love the whole dynamic of the original Ghostbusters. You have Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Ernie Hudson, and Harold Ramis.
Right.
And knowing that Harold has passed away, it was hard for me to like, God, how are they going to do this? How are they going to tie all that in with a new movie, new cast, and having one of their key characters not here with us anymore? And my expectations were, I would say, kind of in the middle, just because it's Ghostbusters and it has that nostalgia feeling for me. But I was blown away. I was just blown away by the movie. And I don't want to give away the ending, but I think Ghostbuster fans will be pleased.
Yeah, I went in trying to keep my expectations low. I like Paul Rudd a lot. Mm-hmm. I like the cast that they've put together. But again, the handover movie that they tried to do a few years ago, they refer to it as the ladies Ghostbusters movie, did not do well. I mean, I guess it did well financially, but not critically or with the fan base. It did well financially, but not enough to bring a sequel. I was disappointed in it. I wasn't disappointed in those actresses. I just thought that they weren't given a very strong script. And there wasn't heart to the movie like there was in the originals. I really started feeling good about Ghostbusters Afterlife once I started seeing from many different critics that, you know, usually are very stodgy, saying this movie kind of hit it all for them. Emotions, nostalgia, brought some real joy and some tears. So I went in with that low expectation, but high hope. And I really felt the only complaint I have is that it takes too long. It's a slow, steady build. But what they're doing is introducing us to a whole new generation of Ghostbusters, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, giving us backstory and what's happened to the original crew in this time. But there's just, it was, in my estimation, just a little too slow. If they'd have pulled maybe 20 minutes out of this movie.
Yeah.
15 to 20 minutes. And I know that's hard because you want to give enough time to start to care and like these characters, which I felt they didn't really do well in the reboot of the series a few years ago. I get that dangerous line they're walking, and you have to build some heart behind this. But once you get into the flow of the movie, it does fan service. There are a lot of nods to the original movies, and stay through all the way to the end of the movie, folks. That's all I'm going to tell you. I saw a lot of people leaving early. Just stay through. It's a fun little visit throughout the flick. The only person I'm still disappointed that didn't make this remake was Rick Moranis.
Yes. Yes. We miss Rick.
That was the only part I wish they would have found a way. I know Rick has really kind of stepped away from acting, but, you know, even if it would have been a 30-second Skype call or something, you know, just to kind of show him in the mix. But it was great seeing Ernie Hudson, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray back in their roles and kind of having that same vibe together when they're on screen. So I really enjoyed that. You know, there's a few other great little cameos throughout the movie that I think people will dig. So on a scale of 1 to 5, 1, it's horrible, 5, it's amazing. I would give this movie a solid 4 because, again, I thought it had a lot of heart to it. It was entertaining, just a little too long. That's my only complaint for this entire movie. And I'm actually interested to see where they take this next. Now, I know last week we talked on the show about the fact that they're considering a TV series, like a Netflix or Amazon Prime TV series. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I could see this playing very well, especially with this current crew. I could see this being a fun TV series. So I'm not opposed to seeing where it goes from here.
Yeah, I'm right with you on that one. I would rate it about a 4 because, yeah, they could have cut a little bit out of the movie. And I know there's been rumors back and forth the last couple of years that Rick Moranis might get back into acting. So I'm not sure why. Maybe he didn't want to make a cameo in this. But
well, he did get back in acting. I think he did a commercial. He did one or two little things, and then he got punched in the head randomly on the street in New York City, I think it was, and dropped. And I really haven't heard much from him or about him since. So our thoughts and prayers are out with Rick Moranis as well. I hope that whatever it is keeping him from acting brings him back to it because he is sorely missed.
Yeah.
Now, we did watch another movie, and we just did this on Monday night on my birthday. went out for dinner, some delicious ribs, came back, wanted to watch a scary movie. And we sat down with my daughter Ripley and we watched a movie called The Girl That Got Away. And I just happened to be scanning through like Amazon Prime new movies that were popping up. And I saw the trailer for this and I thought, wow, this looks like it could be potentially good. As we mentioned, nothing about the premise of Ghostbusters Afterlife, and that there's a reason for that other than, you know, it's kind of a introduction of a new generation. That's about all I want to leave you with. I want you to enjoy every magical moment that happens in Ghostbusters Afterlife without us telling you anything. Now, in The Girl That Got Away, I will tell you it's an interesting setup. This kind of weird woman is snatching girls and keeping them hidden in the woods in this little shanty house. And just, it's a bizarre story. And a girl gets away. And we get to kind of follow what happens to her from childhood to, you know, when she's suddenly an adult in this town. And then the killer is kind of unleashed again, just like the new Halloween movie. It was more, I would say, a psychological thriller than a horror movie per se.
Mm-hmm.
And the commercial, the trailer for it made me a lot more excited about it than the movie. The movie is a full 2 hours long and it's about 45 minutes too long.
it was like one of those never ending movies.
It languished a lot. There was just a lot of downtime. And I know they were trying to build tension, but it wasn't working. It was still an interesting movie. I would say for kind of the originality of what they were going for and the concept, I would give that a 4 out of 5. But overall, this movie kind of fell flat for me. I'm going to go about 3 out of 5 stars. The Girl That Got Away. It's on Amazon Prime. I think it was $4.99 rental. I got my $5 out of it. But I just, like I said, again, this was my movie. You know, probably they could have pulled a half an hour out of it and it would have flowed a lot better.
Hmm. I mean, I honestly didn't really care for it. I just felt like it was very disjointed, though the storyline and what the base of the movie is original. But it just, to me, it felt very disjointed. But, you know, if you're into psychological thrillers, you know, it could be the movie for you. I mean, to me, it just felt very slow. And I understand that tension build, but it, like you said, it just wasn't building that tension enough for you. So
Not a good tension. It was more like, just get to it, just get to it, yeah. As opposed to, oh my God, what's going to happen? When is this? You know, like Hitchcock said, the tension isn't in something happening. It's in the bomb under the table, but the two people talking at the table don't know it's there. And you, yes, and the audience are on the edge of your seat. And in this movie, it's kind of the opposite. It's like the ticking time bombs. You know, everybody's kind of aware of it, except for the main characters again, but in a different way. It's just, It like I said, 3 out of 5, maybe you guys will like it a lot more. What are you going to give it? 3 out of 5 as well?
I would say 2.5.
2.5 out of 5. Oh, that seems fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
That seems fair. All right. Well, let's get to it. It is Supernatural News and Parashare. I said it is the Headless Horseman edition. I had a story sent in to us from Legends of America and El Muerto, the Headless Horseman. This was an interesting story, so I wanted to share it, kind of a parashare in itself. In the 1800s, Texas was a wild and lawless place, attracting all manner of thieves, murderers, and other ruthless outlaws. To combat these many desperados and fight the Indians who were prone to attacking the white settlers, in rode the Texas Rangers, who set about in taming the Wild West frontier. The Rio Grande to the south had been declared the border between the United States and Mexico. However, the Mexican government refused to recognize this boundary, insisting instead that the Nueces River was the border. This left a giant chunk of land between the two rivers, which became known as no man's land, and that was a prime target for outlaws. The dispute between the two countries finally forced the United States to go to war with Mexico in 1846 to make the Rio Grande the official border. However, it would only take about another 30 years before the Texas Rangers could rid the territory of the Mexican cattle rustlers and all of the thieves, the banditos. Now, the Texas Rangers, a roving posse of expert gunmen, were not men to be messed with, following their adversaries everywhere. They lived out of the saddle, and they often dispensed justice in a very brutal way. Two of these men were Creed Taylor and William Alexander Anderson Bigfoot Wallace. That would not fit well on the back of a football jersey.
No.
I love the fact that his nickname is Bigfoot, who was himself a folk hero. It was Bigfoot with Creed's blessing who unwittingly created El Muerto. In 1850, a man known simply as Vidal was busy rustling cattle all over South Texas, and soon he had a high price on his head, dead or alive. During that summer, Vidal took advantage of a Comanche raid, which pulled most of the men northward to fight off the attack. In the meantime, the sparse settlements were temporarily left unguarded. Vidal, along with three of his henchmen, wasted no time in taking advantage of the situation and gathered up a considerable number of horses on the San Antonio River, heading southwest towards Mexico. What Vidal didn't know was that among the stolen herd were several prized Mustangs belonging to Texas Ranger Creed Taylor, usually one of the first to defend the settlements against Indian attacks. Had not, on this occasion, gone after the Comanche. Creed's ranch lay just west of San Antonio, in the thickest of bandit territory, not far from the headwaters of the Nueces River. But due to the location of the ranch, Taylor's livestock and horses were often the targets of many of the bandits. Taylor had enough and quickly gathered fellow ranger Bigfoot Wallace and a nearby rancher by the name of Flores. Both Wallace and Taylor were as skilled as any Comanche when tracking, and the three men shortly found the trail of Vidal and his henchmen. When the three men found the outlaw camp, they waited until night when the bandits were sleeping to attack. Catching them unaware, the thieves were killed, but just killing them, that wasn't enough. Taylor and Wallace wanted to set an example that would deter future bandits. In those days, stealing cattle and horses was a crime more serious than murder. The rangers had tried all types of brutal justice, including stringing them up in trees and leaving them hanging, shooting them, chopping them into pieces, leaving their bodies for animal bait, but nothing had worked to deter the outlaws. In a dramatic example of frontier justice, Wallace beheaded Vidal, then lashed him firmly into a saddle on the back of a wild Mustang, tying the outlaw's hands to the pommel and securing the torso to hold him upright. Bigfoot then attached Vidal's head and sombrero to the saddle with a long strap of rawhide. He then turned the bucking horse loose to wander the Texas hills with its terrible burden on its back. Soon, stories began to abound about the headless rider, seen usually in remote country, with its sombreroed head swinging back and forth to the rhythm of the horse's gallop. As time went on, more and more cowboys spotted the dark horse and its fearsome cargo, and not knowing what it was, they riddled it with bullets. But the horse and its rider rode on, and the legend of El Muerto, the headless one, began. Soon, the South Texas brush country became a place to avoid, as El Muerto was credited with all kinds of evil and misfortune. Finally, a posse of local ranchers captured the wild pony at a watering hole near the tiny community of Ben Bolt, just south of Alice, Texas. Still strapped firmly on its back was the dried-up corpse of Vidal, now riddled by scores of bullet holes and Indian arrows. The body was buried in an unmarked grave near Ben Bolt, and the horse was free of its burden at last. That should have been the end of El Muerto, but the legend would live on to this day. Soon after Vidal's body was laid to rest, soldiers at Fort Inge, I believe it is, I-N-G-E, began to see the headless rider. Travelers and ranchers in no man's land also reported continuing to see this apparition. In 1917, a couple traveling by covered wagon to San Diego, Texas, camped for the night outside of town. They would report the next day that as they sat by the campfire, a large gray stallion sped by with a headless horseman shouting, "It's mine! It's all mine!" Another sighting of the headless wonder was reported near Freer, Texas in 1969. The legend lives on, and still today, many people report seeing the headless rider galloping through the mesquite on clear and moonlit nights in South Texas. I did not know that there was a headless horseman story in Texas.
No, I didn't either. I mean, the only headless horseman story I know of is the Ichabod Crane.
Right, Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, that would creep me out. If I'm I'm not usually scared of ghosts, but if I saw that, I think I would have to turn and run the other way, because that's not normal to see a body with no head on a horse.
Well, agreed. Thanks for the oversimplification of that. Serious. But yes, that's something very rare. Hopefully something we'll never have to see. All right. Our next story is here. And folks, like most of the stories that I read on this, we've got pictures, videos, things that we will share and that you can see for yourself by going to darknessradio.com and click on the news tab. This story is pretty crazy. A man claims a spooky video shows a ghost dog playing with his pup. And I'm looking at this footage myself. I cannot explain it. Mm-hmm. It is very strange. Was it a case of paranormal activity? Maybe it was poltergeist. Australia's Jake DeMarco was left shaken after a bone-chilling CCTV clip appeared to show his pet pup Ryder playing with a ghost dog in his backyard in Melbourne. The pet cemetery evoking video, reposted by Cater's news agency, shows Ryder chasing a translucent white pooch around outside the fenced area. The two canines can be seen playfully frolicking by a water tower before Ryder's alleged phantom friend just scurries out of the frame. DeMarco, 38, told Cater's he was particularly shocked at seeing the second dog in his backyard, which is reportedly secured by a locked high fence and therefore impossible for a canine to breach. Now, upon spotting this freaky footage, the frightened father of two ran outside to try to spot Ryder's paranormal seeming playmate. However, by the time the Casper canine had gotten out there, the Casper canine had vanished. And this isn't the first time an alleged spectral entity has been caught on camera. In February, urban explorers received the fright of a lifetime after encountering a mysterious disappearing figure while pursuing an infamous abandoned nursing home in the UK. But this footage, you can go on our website and see it at darknessradio.com. Click on the news and you'll see the man claims spooky video shows ghost dog playing. It's crazy. First of all, his dog, I don't know what kind it is, almost looks like kind of a greyhound or a Doberman kind of shaped body. And yeah, it's very dark. And then you see this wispy, almost exactly the same size and shape, ghostly white version of the same looking dog dancing and prancing around him.
Yeah. I could see the shape of it, but yeah, it almost looks translucent, like it's not fully solid.
Right. And as the video goes, you'll see it. There are points when like the dogs will cross and you can see the black dog behind the white dog. You can actually see through it. So it's really weird. Very, very strange piece of evidence. Let me see what else we've got going here. This is interesting, right? We're fans of The Simpsons in this household.
Oh, yeah.
Well, predicting 9/11 was just an insane coincidence, says The Simpsons showrunner. One of the original writers for The Simpsons has revealed why he believes the show has such an uncanny ability to accurately guess things that will take place in the future. Indeed, in its over 30 years on the air, the animated Nostradamus has been credited with predicting everything from Roy Horn being mauled by a tiger to fish having three eyes, Apple's keyboards having a glitch, the big Game of Thrones surprise ending, European beef being contaminated with horse meat, and perhaps most famously, the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. The showrunner of The Simpsons, Al Jean, who has been writing for the show since it premiered back in 1989, believes the trick to its correct prognostications is both luck and the sheer quantity of episodes that have been produced. One of our writers, the guy whose episode predicted Donald Trump as president, said it best. If you write 700 episodes and you don't predict anything, you're pretty bad. If you throw enough darts, you're going to get some bullseye, Gene told NME recently. Still, he notes that he finds the show's unintentional 9/11 prediction particularly strange. And this is a weird one. I will admit it's an interesting picture. The 9/11 one is very bizarre, said Gene. In the episode, in the World Trade Center episode, City of New York versus Homer Simpson is the episode you can find this in. We do have a screen cap of this picture in the newspaper, or in our news section, rather, not our newspaper, but you can go see it. Anyway, there's a brochure that Lisa is holding up, and it says, it's got the dollar sign, then it says nine, so it's $9. There was a brochure reading $9 a day, and then behind the bus, you see the Twin Towers. So on this, it looks like 9/11, which is pretty weird. Mm-hmm. That was done in 1996, which was crazy that this type of insane coincidence would take place. And it's not just Providence that makes the Simpsons writer so good at randomly seeing beyond the present, though. It's also intelligence. Mostly, it's just educated guesses, Gene continued. Stanley Kubrick made his movie 2001 A Space Odyssey back in 1968, and there's Zoom and iPads in it, but that's because he had futurologists helping him construct what the world might look like in 30 years' time. As for the show's own future, Gene says that another Simpsons movie is down the line, although animators already have more than enough on their plates just creating the TV show. We're cursed by high ratings, Gene said. We're still on the air as a TV show, and that takes up a lot of time. I worked on the first movie simultaneously and on the show, and it nearly killed the animators. But we have an idea. It's just that we're waiting to see what the environment is. So there might be some more Simpsons news coming along, more Simpsons shows, which is going to make our next story even better. Right. Yeah, this is an interesting one. A man hospitalized. Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong. We're not there yet. Man waking up from a 25 year coma is pumped that the Simpsons are still on. I think we have the audio of him when he woke up and realized it. Woohoo! A Detroit man recently awoke from a coma he's been in since 1996 and was reportedly overjoyed that his favorite show, The Simpsons, still airs every Sunday on Fox. Oh my God, this is too good to be true, said Jerry Elwood, who suffered severe head trauma in a car accident 25 years ago and has been in a coma until his surprise awakening. As you can imagine, it's been a wild couple of days adjusting to the world and all of the innovations that have been made this century. But at least there are some familiar comforts, like the Great American Satire still going strong, surely carrying on its own proud tradition of scathing humor and unparalleled consistency. Can't wait to get home and start catching up. You might be a little disappointed in that. Just a little. Imagine one day you're watching your favorite TV show at your friend's place. You get in your car to drive home, and then you wake up in a hospital and there's hundreds of new episodes, added Elwood. Pretty cool, huh? Family members were unsure how best to address the later seasons of The Simpsons to Jerry as he became familiar with the new modern world. I really feel like we should just warn him, but I don't want to overwhelm him, said Cynthia Elwood, Jerry's mother. Put yourself in his shoes, will you? You've just woken from a 25-year coma. You're learning about smartphones and COVID and everything in between, and the last thing we need to tell him right now is that the greatest show of all time now merely exists as a shell of its former self, an undying reminder that literally every good thing in the world eventually turns to shit. It might be too much to handle, according to this article. Elwood's doctors warn the patients waking up from extended comas often find trouble adjusting to the modern world, the hardest part of their recovery. Oh, yeah, with physical therapy and proper treatment, the physical stuff can be taken care of, no problem, said Dr. Roxanne Chandler, who oversaw Elwood for several years. What will take longer to grasp is that we're still getting weekly installments of these beloved characters portrayed by that incredible voice cast. But we all just sort of shrug about it because it's just fine at best. That's the part that's going to take a while for Jerry to adjust to. Oh, my God. As of press time, Elwood was also super pumped to find out he had 8 Star Wars movies to catch up on. Oh, my God. This has got to be like a satire story, but I don't think it is.
Well, if you were in a coma for 25 years and you woke up, what was one thing that you hope is still around?
McRib sandwiches.
McRib.
There is no other question out there to discuss. The McRib sandwich would be the main thing. You're welcome, McDonald's. You're welcome. Yeah, that would still be my jam right there. That would be the thing that would excite me. I don't know. What would I be excited to see that is still around if I've been in a coma for 25 years, my kids, my wife, perhaps, I don't know, unless of course she's now Mrs. Juan Valdez, the pool boy's wife. I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't be as thrilled to see that happen. I don't know. Yeah, I just think of all the stuff I've missed, but again, all the headaches I've missed as well. Here's what I would say. It's really tough because you saw me the other day on my birthday, all maudlin, looking through pictures of my kids, and now they're all, you know, high teens and adults, and that my heart just crushes because it's like, God, I just wish I had those moments back when they were little and cuddly and affectionate and sweet, and you'll never get that back.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Never get that back. So that's kind of been a big bummer for me. But I don't know. I wouldn't want to have missed much. I mean, there are a few months here and there, and all of 2020 can kiss my ass, but
exactly.
The rest has been okay. But at least we're not this next guy.
Oh.
Yeah. You like that picture? a man has been hospitalized with a mysterious seizure and was diagnosed with tapeworms that have been living in his brain for decades.
Oh.
Doctors who treated a man hospitalized with seizures, disorientation, and strange behavior, you know, mostly paranormal investigators, said tapeworms had been living in his brain for years, undetected, according to a case study published Thursday in the New England Journal of Medicine. The 38-year-old man appeared to be in perfect health until one night when his wife awoke to find him on the floor shaking and speaking gibberish, according to the case report. Well, now you have a reason to send me to the hospital, honey. Have them check for tapeworms next time you like that. He was hospitalized. The doctors treated him for a seizure, noting that he was unresponsive to questions and seemed to be involuntarily gazing at the ceiling. The man had no notable history of illness, no medication or drug use, and no symptoms until the seizures, his family told doctors. The medical team at Massachusetts General Hospital eventually provided a diagnosis of cysticercosis, otherwise known as a tapeworm infection, which was confined via brain scans and blood testing. Two decades earlier, the patient had emigrated from a rural area in Guatemala where parasite-related illness is endemic. According to the case study, parasites from eating undercooked and unsanitary meat or fish can be passed from person to person if people with infections don't wash their hands after using the bathroom. There's another reason to wash your hands, you pigs.
Oh, my God. Gross.
Tiny parasite eggs in the person's poop can spread to other surfaces or even food and then be ingested by someone else, passing the worms along. Symptoms of infection include digestive upset, which I have, weight loss, not me, and abdominal pain, which I do have. But the parasite doesn't necessarily stay in your digestive system. The critter's larva can also migrate through your body into the muscle and to the brain via the bloodstream, potentially causing a range of symptoms. For instance, in a similar case of parasite-related seizures back in 2019, a 43-year-old man in China complained of headaches, leading to the discovery of hundreds of tapeworms inside his brain. The symptoms included seizures, starting about a month after he dined on a pork hot pot he felt unsure about. Okay, folks, if you're eating something and you start to feel unsure of it, just stop. There's no meal worth it going, well, but I'm really hungry. No. In one case in 2020, a woman complained of a sore throat. Doctors found an inch-long parasitic roundworm in her tonsil, most likely caused by sashimi that she ate 5 days earlier.
Oh.
It can also take years for symptoms to appear. However, since the parasite's eggs can lie in wait inside the body without prompting an immune response, that's what Ars Technia reported. So they could just live in your body for years. Your immune system, it just keeps walking right past it, doesn't even recognize them.
Oh, that's nasty.
Yeah. In regions where parasites are more common, including parts of Asia and Central America, as half of epilepsies. Good God, get me tested. Too many undercooked McRibs. That's got to be it. It says, in regions where parasites are more common, including parts of Asia and Central America, As many as half of epilepsy cases are related to tapeworm infections in the brain, according to research. Tapeworms, specifically, can also be found in some parts of the U.S., including Texas, Southern California, and New York City, according to the case study. Why do I have a feeling it's Texans, U.S., Southern Californians, and New York residents spreading that rumor to keep people from coming?
Yeah, because looking at this thing, I wouldn't want to go anywhere near it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this looks like it came straight out of a cave on Tatooine in Star Wars. It's nasty looking.
Here's your nerd card, by the way. Well played.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Fear of the parasites have driven a trend downward toward viral cleanses. Products that claim to deworm the body to heal ailments as varied as brain fog and weight problems. The idea that there's a living organism inside us robbing us of nutrition and health is something people can latch onto. And the fear is a selling point, Stoller said. The best way to prevent tapeworms is cook your meat, especially pork, to an internal temperature of between 145 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, according to the CDC. Thoroughly wash your hands and any plates or utensils after contact with raw meat. Always wash your hands after using the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. It's sad that we even have to tell people that. Look at that parasite. Look at that thing. It looks like the top of the Predator's head.
Yeah.
Like his helmety thing. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it looks like it's something out of this world. Like maybe it's an alien. I don't know, because that's what it looks like. It doesn't look anything earthly at all.
No.
and to know that we can contract that, no thank you.
Yeah. Oh, hideous. All right. We have got a story to share here. Bruce Springsteen was recently on the Colbert Report or on the Colbert Show. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Colbert was asking his Colbert questionnaire. And he asks a string of questions of his guest. And this was one that kind of intrigued me. You know, obviously, Springsteen's new album, Letter to You, has a lot of, songs related to getting older, death, ghosts, just having those memories. And he's certainly written about it throughout his career. But here was an interesting point. We'll go ahead and let Colbert and the boss take over from here.
Yeah. What do you think happens when we die, Bruce?
Okay, individual consciousness, adios. But our souls and our spirits, I think, grow and live on with the people that we've loved and who've loved us and with people we've had impact on with our work or with in our daily experience. So I'm going with that. That's okay.
Is Demon in the White House. You're going to want to check this out. Again, it is on November 26th, exclusively on Discovery Plus, the new Shock Doc I'm a part of. Also, another great Shock Doc, if you haven't seen it, The Curse of Lizzie Borden. That's the new program that I filmed a few months back and aired, I think, a month or two ago on Discovery Plus. So this weekend, if you're kicking around looking for a few things and you're tired of reruns of Holzer Files and Ghost Adventures, go check out Discovery Plus, The Curse of Lizzie Borden, and then check out the new Shock Doc, Demon in the White House, again on Discovery Plus. All right. I've got another piece of audio story here that I've got to figure out exactly how I'm going to get this to play in uno momento. It's an interesting story. What if aliens are future versions of humans, which is something that we've talked about on the show in the past? Very unusual, but I think there's something to this. Now let me see if I can bring it up and share this with our lovely audience. Let me see. Yeah, there we go. I think that's it. Uh-huh. And we'll do this. And let's go ahead and give them a listen.
What if you found out that you had a long-lost relative? And what if that long-lost relative was from a different planet in our galaxy? And What if this faraway planet was home to billions of humans, just like Earth? But these humans don't look anything like us because they're from the future. Could aliens be future versions of humans? How far ahead of us would they be? How much would they have evolved? Would we be able to understand each other? And what would meeting future humans mean for humanity on Earth? This is What If, and here's what would happen if aliens were future humans. In 1947, a mysterious object crashed in the desert near Roswell, New Mexico. You all know this story, but could it really be aliens? The mysterious object was officially declared to be a U.S. Army Air Force balloon. But then, decades later, U.S. Navy Commander George W. Hoover, who had top secret clearance, revealed that the mysterious crash involved time-traveling humans. Somehow, these future humans had developed the technology to overcome the technological limitations that prevent us present-day humans from making the same type of trip. Some theories suggest that these future humans travel back in time in order to understand their biological past. Maybe these same time travelers helped our ancestors to make huge leaps in scientific and technological knowledge in a relatively short amount of time. But if any of these theories are true, should we be prepared for another alien-human visit sometime in the near future? And what might we expect from this close encounter of the third kind? If future humans, were to come and visit us again, they would probably look similar to how they appear in movies. Like us, they'd still walk on 2 feet, but their heads and their eyes would be much larger. This fits with predictions of how present-day humans will continue to evolve. We can expect our heads to be bigger and our upper skull to become more rounded to accommodate a larger brain. And as our civilization advances enough for interplanetary travel, our eyes would get bigger so we can see better in dimmer environments that are further away from the sun. Future humans might also find a way to slow the aging process. So it would be possible to make several trips to places thousands of light years away within one lifetime. If we want to travel somewhere that's 60,000 light years away, and if our technology could do it, then it would be a 60-year flight for anyone on board. But when they got back to Earth, 60,000 years would have passed. We'd like to think that humans of the future would solve this problem so they could visit Earth and come home to tell their family and friends about their trip. But if future humans find a way to live for thousands of years, would that lead to a massive overpopulation on whichever planet they inhabit? Well, chances are, if they make it possible to live that long, they will probably succeed in optimizing their existence before that. Their civilization would undoubtedly be a lot more efficient than ours. The reason being is that they could be centuries, if not millennia, ahead of us in evolutionary terms. Future humans would be a lot smarter, and they'd have better technology to maximize their space and live in densely populated worlds without producing the same high levels of pollution that we do on Earth. In fact, you could bet that future humans wouldn't just have better technology, they'd be technology. Just like some humans today have implants to perceive sound or to detect atmospheric pressure, the humans of the future would likely have dozens of technological implants to make their lives easier. Think about everything your cell phone does for you. Now, imagine you could command it with your thoughts and that it would only be a small chip in your brain. A chip or implant like that might also explain why those who claim to have encountered aliens have said that the aliens spoke to them in their native language. Could future humans simply have automatic language translators implanted in their brains? Or would humans of the future evolve past different languages, instead using one universal language, like Esperanto? If you think this topic has more to it than just a what if, then why don't you join us on the What If Discussed podcast? We go further in depth with the possibilities of aliens actually being humans from the future with Dr. Mike Masters of Montana Tech University, who has written a book postulating that aliens are actually...
Very cool. What if, what if, what if all of these creepy ass aspects, what if we're able to use our cell phone through our brain, simply thinking of the person's number? That could get you in trouble at specific times.
Yeah.
Very, very weird. We got an interesting story here. Let me get to the topic of this. I would put up the actual photograph that's in the article, but it's so grainy, it's impossible to see. So you just have to go to our website to kind of see it for yourself. So if you're looking on YouTube and seeing this image, I've just put up a placeholder image of a dog man to capture this story. Man captures horrifying half man, half dog creature that stalked him. A man in Australia claims he's been stalked by a bizarre dog man creature in the outback, saying he's now sharing his story of the terrifying encounters to protect others. John was fishing in his kayak in the Australian bush on Boxing Day last year when he heard a snap come from the woods next to him. He was previously skeptical of reports of a half-human, half-dog-like creature, which first originated in Michigan in the United States back in the 1800s and have since spread across the world, but now feels convinced this is exactly what he saw. Detailing what happened, he said, "I noticed that every time I took a stroke with the paddle of my kayak, whatever this thing was, it was taking a stride to each paddle I was taking. I stopped for a bit and the sound stopped in the bush too, and I thought it was a bit odd, so I took off paddling again, and sure enough, as soon as I started to paddle, every stroke, this thing would take a step. So whatever it was, this thing was following me. It wasn't a coincidence. It was more of a stalk." After spotting this blackish figure in the trees, John got out his phone and took a photograph. He continued, "The creature, I actually got it in the photo of what I think it is. I've spoken to a few people and I reckon it's Dog Man." Now, after that, I couldn't go back to that area to check it out by myself. I was petrified for probably a month after. I was waking up in the middle of the night and seeing the creature in my dreams. John said things got worse when he returned to the area to fish again, recalling how he heard a bit of a bang and then something running. As it was running, it was smashing trees out of the way, he said. "I don't know if they were breaking it or it was hitting them. You couldn't see what the bush was. It was just so thick." The supposed beast then began to roar before taking a breath in that was even louder. John said it just went to a whole nother level, adding, "It was crazy. I could hear in my head something saying, 'Go now or you'll die.' Or perhaps more like, 'Hey, go now or you'll die.'" That's probably the better Dogman voice. "It wasn't my own voice, my own consciousness. It was something else. That 10 minutes was probably the longest in my whole life. I thought I was going to be killed. I had no weapons. I didn't even have my fishing knife, no phone service." Thankfully, he was able to escape in his car, but now fears that others may not be so lucky, which is why he's speaking out. "I had heard about it, the dog man, and thought it was a joke, but actually, I've had encounters with it now. It's terrifying," he said. "I wouldn't be putting myself out there showing these photos if it was a fake, or I don't know that there were actually something out there. That's the main reason I came forward. I'm worried that someone's going to go missing or get hurt, and I'll have it in the back of my mind that I should have told someone about that." Interesting. It's weird. You guys take a look at the picture for yourself. Well, first of all, in Australia, everything's trying to kill you.
Yeah, right.
Everything is trying to kill you. So that would make me nervous just in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, folks, Darkness Radio presents the Holzer Files Hell Frozen Over event, January 7th through the 9th, with myself, Dave Schrader. Shane Pittman is joining me. Paranormal engineer Bill Chappell is coming in. And Jamie Houck, the medium, will be on hand. We're going to be there all weekend long. The ghost hunts are sold out, but our meet and greet party on Friday and our talks all day on Saturday, there are tickets still available. It's only $99 for the weekend. You get to come on in and meet with Shane and myself, Bill Chappell, Jamie Houck. We're going to have a great time. You can get more information over at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. You can also find more information on other great places I'm going to be, including the Las Vegas Para Unity Conference coming up here in December, which is, I believe, the 9th through the 11th in December at the MGM Grand Hotel. And there are still tickets available for that if you want to join us. That's December. Hell Freezes Over event in Sauk Center, Minnesota, takes place January 7th through the 9th. The reason I call it Hell Frozen Over is because Shane Pittman told me hell would have to freeze over before he would find himself in Minnesota in the winter, and he's agreed to be here. So hell has officially frozen over. I hope you guys will check that out. A lot of other great events coming up throughout the next year, so make sure you go check out our website and sign up for one of the cool things that we've got going right in your area. I do have an email here. Hi, Dave. Okay. I want to write to you about my experience referencing the Bold Street time slip. Kind of hard to explain, but something happened and felt you were the right person to tell as you referenced it on one of your podcast shows. This morning, my wife got up just before I left work, made a cup of tea, then sat down and gave me that look. You know the one, Dave, the look. And just said, Aaron is seeing a ghost, my oldest son, and the shadow figures at work and is concerned. I nearly dropped my cup. He says that he always sees this man and always standing in the doorway. What concerns him is he is the same height, and my son is nearly 6 feet tall and very broad. He is juggling university and trying to hold a part-time job down. Says when he's at work and preparing customers' orders, he notices shadows coming across him and at the corners of his eyes. Now the thing is, he doesn't believe in all of this stuff. My wife is Roman Catholic and is saying, do I get a priest? I listen to podcasts and I watch all the TV shows, and I'm more attracted to the shows for their subject and curiosity, but still not 100% that it's all paranormal. I don't practice or try anything. I just like the entertainment value. And when I see you going through stuff at an investigation, I think, yeah, go on, Dave, rather you than me.
Right?
Well, you know why I send Shane to all the scary places? Better Shane than me. Mm-hmm. But not to digress, that's what his email says. My main question is, what do I do? I kind of had a bit of shock hearing this morning. Obviously, my son took comfort in confiding to his mom, but I'm like, okay, you listen, you watch the shows. Now this might be happening in my own home. Again, I don't want to do anything that I don't understand and don't want to make stuff worse. If it is a haunting, or is it an attachment? Can this get nasty? Nothing strange has started happening at the house, and myself, along with my wife and our younger son, haven't noticed anything strange. If you can just give me some basic advice or put me in touch with anyone, it'd be appreciated. Could he be a sensitive? I don't know, Dave. And after watching and listening to all of your shows and everything else that's out there, my brain has frozen over. And if I'm honest, I'm a bit confused now on how to deal with this. Kind regards, Kevin. Well, Kevin, yes, apparently your son is sensitive. I don't know where in the world you're located. I would say talk to a holistic center, maybe have him go in. They could teach him how to kind of shut things down or ground himself, protect himself, shield himself. Is it an attachment? I can't tell. I'm not a sensitive, but there are people that might be able to give you some insight to that as well. But if they suddenly want $200 to burn a white candle to set the spirit free, find somebody else. You know, things just happen. People are born with different sensitivities, and your son may just have some abilities, and that's okay. I wouldn't say anything that would spook him. And if he's, you know, just unnerved by seeing this, but the spirits aren't being aggressive, maybe just have him speak to the spirits and say, hey, really, I don't want to see you, and I'd prefer if you're not here. I don't want to connect. I don't want that. And just by putting that out, sometimes the spirits will back off, especially if they, you know, if they believe they're frightening somebody. A lot of times we've had people just put that out there and they say that, and then the spirits beg off and they don't have that problem anymore. So there's a book called The Gift, and the author's last name is Bodine, B-O-D-I-N-E. First name E-C-H-O. Last name Bodine, B-O-D-I-N-E. That book is really a great book to kind of launch you off. There's also another book written by the same author called A Still Small Voice, and it talks about the awakening of these abilities. But keep out of the fear factor. Nothing is scary at this point. It's just alarming and new. You'll probably get very used to it, as he will, as it progresses. If you're religious in nature, as you said, your wife is Roman Catholic, the prayer of Michael the Archangel is a great prayer that many, many different exorcists and demonologists use to help clear a location. All right. Hello, Tim and Dave. What the hell? You got the names flipped the wrong way. If you happen to read this on air, then thank you for putting a voice to my story. It means a lot to have someone read and listen to the things that happen, to feel them and feel validated. So I have a few stories from my childhood, but till I work up the courage to write them, I'll start with one at a time. Sorry. Honestly, this is hard to do since it feels just by bringing up old memories is like making whatever used to scare me as a child become aware of me again. But I'm tired of keeping these events bottled up. As a child, my parents would send my brother and I to go visit my aunt and uncle at the time in Nebraska. Their house was old yet well-maintained, beautiful yet out of place, and freaking massive for just two people. It was a perfect place for hide and seek, the perfect summer getaway for my brother and I back in the day. But then when we visited my aunt, she was always very welcoming and would play with us day and night. But she had one rule: never go into the attic. Oh, this sounds like a horror movie coming true, Winnie.
Yeah, it does. Nothing ever good comes out of the attic.
Yeah, and it's always that sweet elderly matronly aunt. Oh, peekaboo. Oh, yes, hide and seek. Oh, here's some fresh cookies. Never go in the attic. Right? Right?
Yeah.
Never. Never. A bit of common sense of a warning, but my aunt was never one to cross. Well, one year while visiting my aunt, I finally asked her why it was such a big deal, or why it was not a big deal to go in the basement, but never the attic. She told us that it was because there were tarantulas and rattlesnakes up there. At the time, being from Arizona and knowing the dangers of both creatures, my brother and I really believed her until the following year. Well, first of all, if Auntie's telling me you have tarantulas and rattlesnakes in the attic, I'm not staying there, period.
Right? I wouldn't even want to be in the house.
Auntie, I did you a favor and burned the place to the ground. You're welcome. All right, flash forward. One of the last times I visited my aunt, we played a game of hide and seek. This also being the last time I ever willingly played that game. It started off as a normal game, my brother unwilling to let me hide with him, to which I would usually end up hiding in the large walk-in closet that was directly across from a much smaller closet that held another door to the attic. This time, though, I wanted to be brave and hide in the attic. Snakes and spiders be damned. I was a preteen that wasn't afraid of anything. But wouldn't you know it, I chickened out last second and hid in the closet that only led to the attic door. Apparently, even daring to stand next to the attic door was a huge mistake. The dread that I felt in that small closet froze me in place. Never in my short life did I ever feel so threatened. And an animal-like fear that if I moved one muscle, I would be in a lot of trouble. I knew something dangerous was behind me, yet above me in the corner of that space. All I could see in that small closet from the light shining under the door was the door leading out of the closet and the door leading to the attic. So whatever was behind me had no point of entry when I first hid in there. It was a clean and empty closet. Two walls, two doors, no holes, no pipes in sight. My tipping point that had me running out of that small space was a deep and chilling growl above me. Then something warm and wet, something that was like a lot of drool falling on my arm. I ran out and straight to my aunt, never telling her what happened, just saying anything about it until it happened. let me rephrase this. And my eyes are jumping around on this. I ran out and straight to my aunt, never telling her what happened, just not saying anything about what happened till later in my 20s and spilling my guts to my friend who convinced me into sharing my stories. As an adult now, I can say for certain that whatever it was in the closet was not natural, but also not evil. It was more of something warning me away from its territory. I'm sure that whatever it was didn't want me there and made sure I felt its intentions, if that makes sense. I know that if I had gone into the attic that day, I wouldn't have been hurt by snakes or spiders or irate ants, but certainly something would have hurt me. It was a warning, and one that in a sense I'm grateful for, but still mystified about. This wasn't the last time I was warned by something either, but that will be for another time, and when I have more courage to share. I know this isn't very scary in comparison to some stories. I mean, there was no physical creature behind me, but still, to me, it was a feeling, a sensation, knowledge that there was something dangerous behind me that intended to harm me if I made the wrong move. That, to me, was worse. When you can't see what you're running or hiding from, then how can you truly escape it? Thank you so much for reading this, and sorry for the typos. I'm genuinely shaken from the memories as I tape this, but I did not try to fix as much as I could. Your loyal friend and fan, Danielle. Thank you, Danielle. We appreciate you sharing your story. And no, that is creepy. When you can't see what's there, but you can feel the breath, you can feel the oozing saliva dripping from its jowls, and you hear the above you. Well, that's just a night of napping with me on the couch, isn't it? Drool on your arm, the
nothing
snoring
evil.
Noise.
Yeah, it's just Dave napping.
That's all. Tim's got such a paranoia of AI and robots.
Yeah.
You know this. Ridiculous, folks. We know that robots are here to help us, and here's proof. It's a shape-shifting robot, and this is pretty neat. Let me copy this, because this is pretty cool, and I want to put this up on the video as well so people can see what this bad boy looks like. There are a lot of new advancements, of course, in technology taking place, things that are going to make our lives a better, you know, run, things that will be able to take care of us. It's weird. I tried to save the picture, but it's not allowing me to. Let me try this again, because I really want to share this bad boy. Where is it? Why is it not showing up? Like Zoink Scoob, something weird.
The technology is not working for you.
No, as I'm talking about how friendly technology is. Oh, there it is. Okay, here we go. I'm going to pop this up on the screen, and it looks very cool, right? Boom, look at that.
Oh, yeah. Right?
It's a neat looking little deal. It's a robot fish, and you love fishing, honey.
Oh, yeah.
Scientists have been looking for new ways to treat cancer for years. Newly developed shape-shifting robots. What could go wrong? We saw shape-shifting robots in Terminator 2.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Shape-shifting robots could provide a new avenue for treatment. The new robots are shaped like little fish and can deliver drugs directly to affected cells. This could help alleviate side effects from cancer-fighting treatments like chemotherapy. The study was conducted as a proof of concept. Researchers reported in ACS Nano that the fish-shaped microbots they created were able to track pH changes. Those changes could then trigger a response from the robots, which would release the chemotherapy drugs to the patients. Researchers and scientists have used micro-scale robots in a multitude of tests. These small robots can manipulate tiny objects, but most of the ones we've seen so far can't change their shape in any way. But in this new study, researchers Zhuan Li, Li Zhang, and Dong Wu, unfortunate, but that is the names, and others worked together to develop these shape-morphing microbots. They designed the robots to use magnets as guides. This would allow doctors to send them to specific sites to deliver treatments. Also, because tumors often exist in microenvironments, the team designed the small tools to change shape and deliver the treatment in response to lowered pH levels. The concept is interesting and could prove helpful in finding new ways to deliver treatment to cancer patients. The scientists demonstrated multiple ways that the microbots could be used. they were able to program the fish-shaped one to open and close its mouth. Take me to the river. Right? That big, big mouth Billy Bass. Yeah. Take me to the water. The researchers could then control when and where it released the drugs because they could control it. They were able to release the chemotherapy drugs closer to the cells that actually needed it. That would allow for less collateral damage to the body and more of a focused treatment for the cancer itself. To start proving the original concept, researchers created 40 printed tiny bots in the shape of a crab. Yeah, you don't want to do that. I've got micro crabs, a butterfly, and a fish. They used pH-responsive hydrogel to create them, then allowed for the robots to activate based on the surrounding pH levels. Once printed, they also made the bots magnetic by placing them in a suspension of iron oxide nanoparticles. This allowed them to control the bots using magnets. Of course, this is just the proof of concept. There aren't any fish-shaped microbots ready to do battle with cancer just yet. Data from this new test could open new doors to cancer treatment, though. Chemotherapy can leave the human body in a weakened state because the drugs used in treatments don't have any way to determine which cells they should attack. Controlling where the drugs go is difficult. Because of this, the entire body suffers. If scientists can prove this concept and design the microbots that are easy to guide, we could have a new cancer treatment option for those who need it. So very cool. Interesting change.
Yeah, that is neat, especially to isolate where the cancer is so your whole body is not ravaged with chemo and sicker than a dog, you know?
Right.
So I'm all for this type of AI technology.
Doom, 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 doom. Yeah. All right, our next story is a terrifying, veiled, ghostly figure story. That's right, a terrifying, veiled, ghostly figure spotted lurking behind a fisherman in a scary photograph. While fishing in the Mojotoro River in the Argentine province of Salta on November 16th, two unnamed fishermen took a selfie to commemorate their trip. But when they looked back at the photo, a wispy figure behind them had seemingly emerged from a tree. They, the two friends who were out fishing with two other people who took the photo, told Chronica News, "This happened last night. We went fishing on the Mojotoro River." Mojotoro sounds like the evil monkey from the the Powerpuff Girls. Mojotoro. They were fishing in the Mojotoro River from 5 p.m. and we stayed there until 10 p.m. We saw the photos when we got home and we couldn't believe our eyes. In the first photo, nothing came out. And in the second, in the same position, a shadowy figure appeared as if it were one of a woman with a veil. The group quickly left the area and they have not yet returned. According to local reports, the river is known for creepy paranormal activity, with regular claims of items moving on their own accord or shadows appearing from nowhere being a regular occurrence. The photos of the fisherman and the creature were uploaded to the interweb, where they may, or many have tried to come up with explanations of what it could be. I don't know. It's a weird ass picture, but it looks like somebody in a sheet.
Yeah, it does. It looks like the traditional ghost that you would cut the eyes out. And
yeah.
But it doesn't look as cheesy as that. It looks something. I don't know. That's kind of hard because it almost looks at the bottom part is translucent as well. So yeah, that's interesting. I don't know how that would be in that picture other unless it is a spirit, you know, photobombing the sky. I don't know.
Oh, this is weird. I just got a story that was sent to me, and it is a woman survives car being flattened by a semi-truck and crawls out of a window in Washington. It's a real-life miracle story, and I've got the video and the story here. Let me see if, again, I can play this, and we'll give it a shot. But this is crazy. Let me go in here and see if I can pull this up. So new to all of this shenanigan, trying to understand how this all works. Let me see. Yes. Okay. Let me see if it's there and we shall share. Hold tight and let us begin sharing now.
Washington State miraculously escapes with only minor injuries after crashing into a semi-truck. Look at the result. Take a look at your screen right there. Troopers say the 46-year-old was driving her Nissan when a truck in front of her slowed down. That's why they have those little gates on the back of the truck underneath. Well, if you're going too fast, that's what could happen to your car. The semi behind her didn't stop, smash into her. That forced her into the truck, and that caused the car to fold in half. The truck landed on top of it. Some troopers say they have never seen anything like that.
He walked up, and he's walking around the car, and he heard, "Help, help." And he's like, "Oh, my goodness." She was able to pull herself out of the car under her own power, which is incredible. This is nothing short of a miracle, in my opinion. I don't know how she survived this.
It's a testimony to the way the car is built, too, right? Officials say the tow truck lifted the front end of the semi off the car, letting the woman crawl out of a gap in the passenger window. Thank goodness, not her day.
That is unflipping believable.
Yeah, that car.
Holy, how is that even possible?
I don't know, because that car was crushed like a pop can. I don't know how anyone could have gotten out of that. She had to have somebody watching over her on that one, because, I mean, I don't even think Houdini could get out of that thing.
Good God. No, that is terrifying. All right, another weird story here. And I know as I say this, my camera suddenly goes bonkers. My computer is going conky. Very strange. Although many have had paranormal experiences throughout their lives, it is true that those that transcend are those famous people tell in great detail. Thus, as narrated among others, Megan Fox, who lived this type of situation on several occasions. It is not the first time Megan Fox tells us, but it is a while ago. Oh my God, forget it. I do not know who wrote this story or in what world that they were living in, but this is the farthest from English I've ever read.
Mm.
Princess Martha Louise recalls seeing paranormal activity after a Nazi killed himself in her room. The self-described clairvoyant used to live at her family's Skagum estate in Asker, just outside Oslo. I have a feeling this story is going to hurt my tongue. Princess Martha Louise of Norway has revealed many interesting stories in a new podcast, including one where she used to witness paranormal activities in her room and later found out that a Nazi had killed himself there. Speaking on Schweizer Illustrate, a Norwegian podcast show, the self-described clairvoyant said that she was highly sensitive in her childhood and used to see special things at her family's Skagum estate in Asker, just outside Oslo. I saw very special things in my room. I was terrified when I slept at night. I got suffocating sensations and everything like that, she said. The 50-year-old then added that it was only in her adulthood that her parents, King Harold and Queen Sonia, revealed to her that one of the Nazis had committed suicide in her room. That's why I had nightmares there. I understand that now, she reflected. German Nazis used to live on the Skagum estate during the Second World War. Among them was one Josef Trebrov, or Trebovin, a Nazi party official and politician who was the long-serving Gauleiter of Gau Essen and the Reichskommissar for Norway. I'm pretty sure I said that right. Reichskommissar. For Norway during the German occupation. A day after Germany's surrender was announced, Trebovin took his own life on May 8, 1945 by detonating 50 kilograms of dynamite in a bunker on the estate. A number of other Germans also took their lives on the property that day, including one who did it in a room that later turned out to be occupied by Princess Martha Louise. The princess dubbed herself a highly sensitive person who is thought to have an increased or deeper central nervous system sensitivity to physical, emotional, or social stimuli. According to researchers, people who possess the personality trait have it from their birth and often have a complex inner life. The Norwegian royal has often spoken about being affected by the trait, noting that she realized it only in her adulthood and used to feel strange about it when she was a child. She said that the people in Norway treated her differently as a weird kid in her younger years, which led to her withdrawal from socialization. The mother of three has recently released a book about spirituality and psychology, and she has co-written with her friend Elizabeth Nording. The book titled Born Sensitive, after her highly sensitive trait, tells the very personal story of her life, of people like her for whom it can be a strength as well. So interesting. How freaky would that be that you share a bedroom in a room that a Nazi took himself out in?
Right. I mean, what kind of icky vibes would you be getting from a spectral Nazi? I mean, it's, I don't know.
For those of you listening, that is the sound of Hans the Wonder Dog scratching himself very near...
Actually, it's our cat, Cheech. He's got a phantom itch, and he keeps scratching the air, but it ends up hitting the table. And I've been trying to get him off our table, but he's refusing because he loves me and wants to be by his mama.
I got it. Weirdo. All right. The Rally. A hospice's nurse video on the unexplained death phenomena goes viral on TikTok. Most people avoid talking about death at all costs, but not Julie McFadden. Oh, no, not Julie, a California hospice nurse who has gone viral on TikTok for talking about just what happens at the end of your life. And this is pretty interesting. McFadden, may be better known as Hospice Nurse Julie on TikTok and Instagram, started making videos on TikTok about 6 months ago after her nieces introduced her to the platform. She now boasts more than 413,000 followers on the video sharing platform. I knew I wanted to get information out in general. I felt like it was a very taboo topic that shouldn't be so taboo, McFadden told USA Today. I think I made like three or four TikToks, and 4 days later, one of them blew up, and it just kept happening over and over again. One of those videos discusses a phenomena dubbed the rally. Hospice patients will suddenly seem like they're getting better. Many resume eating, some start walking again, and others will talk or laugh. This burst of energy is short-lived, however. Many patients die within hours or days of this rally. It happens to probably a third of our hospice patients, McFadden says in the video, so much so that we try to educate the family about this before it happens so it doesn't devastate them when they suddenly pass after doing so well for a few days. And we've actually got that that video. Let me bring that up here and share it because I think this is pretty fascinating. Here's Hospice Nurse Julie. Words are tough. Here we go.
Here's one phenomenon that happens during the death and dying process that medical professionals like myself cannot explain. There's something that happens that we call the rally. This is when someone is really sick and almost towards actively dying, meaning dying within a few days, and then suddenly they look like they are better. This can manifest in different ways, but a lot of times they suddenly will eat, they'll suddenly talk, maybe even walk. They act like their old selves. They have a little more of a personality, kind of laughing, talking, joking. But then usually they die within a few days after this, sometimes even that night. And it happens to probably a third of our hospice patients. So it happens quite a bit, so much so that we try to educate the family about this before it happens. So it doesn't devastate them when they suddenly pass after doing so well for a few days. Like for the second phenomenon that happened.
Yeah, so fascinating stuff. And thank you, Nurse Julie, for sharing your insights on this. The technical term for the occurrence is terminal lucidity. And it's hard to know just how often it happens, said Dr. Christopher Kerr, a hospice physician for 23 years. I don't think there's really good numbers on that, said Kerr. It certainly is safe to say that it's not uncommon. McFadden talks about other unexplained phenomena in her videos, including the occurrence where patients say they see dead relatives, friends, and even pets, some of them up to a month before they pass. The experience usually isn't scary for the patient, McFadden says and explains in her video. It's usually very comforting to them. They usually say they're sending a message like, we're coming to get you soon, or don't worry, we'll help you, McFadden said. Kelly Rice, a senior coordinator for social workers at Tidwell Hospice, said she's seen both of the phenomena in her 11 years of working with hospice patients. One such experience with a patient has always stuck with her, she said, a gentleman who was clearly seeing babies. What I came to find out through his wife is that they had experienced several miscarriages early on, and they never did have children, Rice said. The experience is actually very common, according to research conducted by Kerr and his team. What we found is the vast majority of people, nearly 90% of people, in the last usual weeks of life can report at least one very distinct experience, which is usually vivid, comforting, and meaningful. But what's true for one hospice patient is not true for all, and their experiences are often very individual, Rice said. McFadden said she has worked as a nurse for 14 years, first working as an intensive care unit nurse for 9 or 10 years before transitioning to hospice nursing. It was in the ICU where she became passionate about death and wanting to educate others about it too. McFadden declined to name her place of employment for private reasons. I just saw that there's this missing gap in treating people. the whole person and really figuring out what the family, what the patient would really want long term, McFadden said. McFadden says feedback to her videos has been mostly positive. Most people are interested to learn more, and it's connected her with a whole online community of other people whose jobs involve death. And many couldn't imagine being so close to death, McFadden said. And she'd never do something else. To be able to provide somebody with answers and comfort and care and to help that process be easier, it just feels like a gift, McFadden said. I'm so thankful for people like that, because I know our hospice nurse that was there when my mom passed away was very helpful for me and my family. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's so heartbreaking when it takes place and there's no getting over it. And, you know, having them there kind of walking through it and telling you some of the stories, and talk to the nurses at these places. A lot of them will tell you some of the fascinating stories that have taken place and what they've seen. I know when my mom was passing away, and I've told the story before, but I'm just fascinated by it. He said, I think it was like a couple weeks before my mom had passed away in that same room. He had a patient in there, and he and his other nurses, they were writing information and doing their charting. When they saw her come out and peek around the corner and look at and wave, and he looked at the other two nurses and he goes, "Oh, she's gone." And they're like, "You saw that?" And he's like, "Yep." And they went in, and sure enough, she had passed away, but her spirit came out and waved to him. Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff.
Tip of the cap to them at those nursing homes and hospice care.
All right, folks, keep our buddy Timmy in your thoughts and prayers to recover from COVID and do it fully and healthy. And we keep him in our thoughts and prayers going forward for that. Thank you for tuning in. Winnie, thanks for joining me and sitting in and kind of letting me bounce off of you with this with these stories and goings on.
You're welcome.
That was deep and thought out. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, I thought
you're welcome.
Seriously, I thought it cut out because all of a sudden it like stopped. And I didn't hear anything.
Oh, gotcha. Well, no, we're all still here, but we're heading out now. And we do have another brand new episode that will air tomorrow on Thanksgiving. I hope you all have a great and very happy Thanksgiving, surrounded in love and laughter. And for those of you that are alone this holiday season, I know sometimes it's hard to look back and give thanks, but do it. Be grateful for the good things that are going on in your life. And sometimes they're hard to see through the murk and the mire, but find them. And hold on to them. Cherish those moments. And from us here at Darkness Radio, thank you for tuning in and being part of our world. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. This is Darkness Radio.